From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. From the immediate aftermath of the attacks of September 11, 2001, through 18 years at war, here's what U.S. presidents and political leaders have said about any possibility of agreement with the Taliban in Afghanistan.
We will not waver. We will not tire. We will not falter. And we will not fail.
The United States has a broad range of contacts at many levels across Afghanistan and the region that we are leveraging to support this effort, including very preliminary outreach to members of the Taliban.
The one thing that we do believe is that any insurgent group, including the Taliban, is going to need to accept an Afghan constitution that renounces ties with al-Qaeda.
The Taliban wants to make a deal. We'll see if they want to make a deal. It's got to be a real deal, but we'll see.
That last clip from President Donald Trump this past November. Well, on Saturday in Doha, the U.S. and the Taliban did sign an agreement. So what does it signal and what will come next? This hour on Point, dealing with the Taliban. And we're going to begin today with Ambassador James Dobbins. He joins us from Washington. He's a senior fellow and distinguished chair in diplomacy and security at the RAND Corporation. He was the special envoy for Afghanistan in the administration of George W. Bush and special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan in the Obama administration as well. Ambassador Dobbins, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So what's your first thought on the significance of this weekend signing, U.S.-Taliban signing the agreement?
I think it's a positive step. I think the hard part is still to come. I think the timetables set out in the agreement are probably a little unrealistic and aren't going to be reached. But it's a step in the right direction.
A step in the right direction. And what is that direction?
Well, the direction is a peace agreement between the Taliban and the Afghan government. And the departure of American forces.
So tell me more about that, because that seems to be one of the critical questions here about whether the Taliban and the Afghanistan government are going to reach some sort of agreement themselves.
Well, I agree. That's why I say the hard part is still to come. There are big issues that they have to face. How do they combine to form a coalition government? How do they combine the Taliban fighters and the armed force and the army and police of the Afghan Republic into a single national force? Those are big issues that will take a long time to work out.
Mm. Well, then let's go back a little bit or a long bit, Ambassador. Given that the United States has been involved at war in Afghanistan for 18 years, what are some of the moments that you remember early in your time in Afghanistan that perhaps if we had handled differently, it would have taken us less than 18 years to get here?
Well, I think in the first few months, we made three basic mistakes. One was to believe that a new weak government with no army and no police force could be responsible for the security of its population and its territory. The second mistake was to not take advantage of outreach from senior Taliban leaders, including the top leadership, who were prepared to surrender. And the third was to not recognize that although Pakistan had ceased supporting the Taliban government, they hadn't ceased supporting the Taliban. The combination of those three failures took a long time to remedy, and by the time we did remedy them, the Taliban had reorganized, re-equipped, refunded, and resumed a significant insurgency throughout Afghanistan.
I see. And so therefore, those missed opportunities or those mistakes prolonged war, essentially.
They created the opportunity for an insurgency to arise and create a violent resistance to the American presence. There was no... We talk about having been at war for 18 years, but for the first 3 or 4 years, there was no war. There was a very small American presence, smaller than it is today, and they were mostly focused on hunting down al-Qaeda figures, and the Taliban were licking its wounds in Pakistan and getting ready to come back.
So what do you think are the critical things to watch for in the next couple of days or weeks as the ink dries on this agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban?
Well, the agreement calls for two things to occur over the next few days. One is a prisoner exchange, and the second is opening of talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. They're both supposed to have occurred by 10th of March. That's one of the deadlines I think will be missed. But those are what to look for. The prisoner exchange and whether it takes place, and then whether President Ghani is willing and able to form a broadly based representative delegation to talk to the Taliban, and whether the Taliban are prepared to meet with them, although they have said they would.
Well, you know, it's interesting because just today we're seeing reports from the AFP, for example, that says the Taliban are resuming offensive operations against Afghan security forces, essentially ending the partial truce that preceded the signing of the deal in Doha on Saturday. And that this is happening just a day after President Ghani said he would continue this partial truce until those talks in March 10th. So what does that signify to you?
Well, the truce was only supposed to last for 7 days, and it did last for 7 days. There's no agreement to continue it. President Ghani expressed the hope that it would continue. The U.S. expressed the hope that it would continue. But the Taliban only agreed to a 7-day truce.
So this isn't a collapse of any kind of ceasefire, then?
It's not a collapse of the agreement.
Okay.
If someone wants to make it a make or break issue, if Ghani says that he won't negotiate as long as the fighting continues, then the process will come to a halt. But it's not a violation of the agreement.
I see. I was wondering if the resumption of attacks from the Taliban would put those future talks in peril. And it sounds like, I guess,
it might.
Okay, it might.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things that could go wrong. This is a very delicate process. And that's why I think it's going to move haltingly. But, the Taliban did demonstrate that they're capable of maintaining a ceasefire. That's an important point, that they have sufficient command and control to do it. And they did it for a week, which is what they agreed to.
Hmm. So let me ask you, Ambassador, what do you think it works in this agreement? What do you think has been done right?
Well, I think, we've been talking to the Taliban for 10 years. We started in 2010 in these negotiations. And the major blockage for most of that time was that we wouldn't negotiate in the absence of the Afghan government, and the Taliban wouldn't negotiate in the presence of the Afghan government. So Trump and Khalilzad rather artfully went around this obstacle by forging this two-stage process in which we would negotiate an early preliminary agreement, and then the larger talks with the Taliban and the Afghan government would begin. And so the real question is, will they begin? And we'll have to wait and see.
Hmm. What do you think the biggest difference is regarding the U.S.'s position now versus what it was in 2002, 2005, 2006, every year preceding to this moment now?
Well, in 2002, the U.S. was refusing to talk to the Taliban or even to allow Taliban leadership that wanted to come over and surrender to do so. Those who did were sent to Guantanamo or to prisons in American-run prisons in Afghanistan for years. Even Mullah Omar, the top Taliban leader, offered to Karzai that he would surrender if he was offered immunity, and the position of the Trump of the Bush administration at the time persuaded Karzai to turn that down, although he was inclined to agree. So that's a big change, and that change occurred in 2010 under Obama, when we decided we would talk to the Taliban. The second big change occurred about a year ago when the U.S. agreed to begin negotiations with the Taliban without the Afghan government in the room on a preliminary agreement.
That being a significant change, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Right.
I was wondering if a third big difference is that the United States simply just doesn't have the will to be in Afghanistan anymore.
Well, I think that's not a total change. I mean, Obama wanted to end the war. Obama, in fact, declared in 2014 that we would be out by the end of his term, whether or not there was an agreement. Now, 3 weeks after he made that decision, the Islamic State burst out of Syria, marched to the gates of Baghdad, and nearly took over the country. And that was an evidence of what happens if you abandon one of these campaigns prematurely. So Obama backed off, but Obama was as insistent as Trump was about ending the war and was willing to do so unilaterally if necessary. And Trump has been, you know, has wavered on this. On occasion, he's made very bellicose statements that imply we'll stay as long as we need to. And other times he's talked about ending the war even unilaterally. So I think that war weariness on the part of the U.S. is certainly one factor that encouraged the Taliban to believe that it was worth negotiating with the U.S. And uncertainty about whether we would leave was one of the factors. If they were certain we would leave, then they wouldn't have negotiated. So the uncertainty actually created an opportunity for negotiations.
Well, Ambassador James Dobbins, Senior Fellow and Distinguished Chair in Diplomacy and Security at the RAND Corporation. He was also Special Envoy for Afghanistan in the administration of George W. Bush and Special Representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan in the Obama administration as well. Ambassador Dobbins, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk a lot more about the agreement signed between the U.S. and the Taliban this weekend from the Afghan perspective. And we'll hear from you as well. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the agreement signed between the United States and the Taliban this weekend in Doha and what that means for next steps in Afghanistan. We talk about endless wars. Are we now in a phase of endless peace? Well, let's listen to what General John Allen had to say. He's former commander of the NATO International Security Assistance Force and U.S. forces in Afghanistan. He called the agreement an important step forward in an interview with the BBC's NewsHour this weekend. Allen also said the agreement did not go far enough to protect women in Afghanistan.
And I think for the United States to have signed this agreement without having enshrined in it somewhere that the Taliban would adhere to a U.S. formulation of how women should be treated in the aftermath of the inter-Afghan dialogue, which is phase two of this process, I think leaves the women exposed. And I think it leaves them vulnerable. And all that we have accomplished over these many years of conflict, I think will have been for naught if we can't get this into the agreement.
General John Allen speaking to the BBC. Well, Mohammed Suhail Shaheen is a member of the Taliban's negotiation team. CNN's Nick Robertson asked Shaheen about the guarantees the Taliban will give to women.
Yes, about the role of women, their education, because women want to have education, and women want to have right of work. We do not have any problem with that.
It's Mohammed Suhail Shaheen speaking to CNN. Well, joining us now from New York is Maryam Wardak. She served under two presidential administrations in the Afghan government, most recently in the Office of National Security of the National Security Council in President Ghani's administration. She's anchor of South Asia Diary with Maryam Wardak, a weekly show on World is One News, an Indian-based network. And she's also founder of Her Afghanistan, an online platform supporting Afghan women. Maryam Wardak, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us from Washington is Michael Kugelman. He's director, deputy director and senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. Michael, welcome to you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So, Maryam, first of all, let's just take this question of the future of for Afghan women head on. Do you think what do you think of what General Allen had to say, that he's concerned about next steps for women in Afghanistan?
I think it's very generous that the world community in general is concerned for the women of Afghanistan. But I think that we also need to reflect that the world community did not know what was best for the Afghan women at the time when they entered Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. As an Afghan American, I felt that I had a responsibility to show the best of both sides to both nations. When I was in Afghanistan for the past 10 years, I had to constantly explain to the Afghans that as an American, that the Americans were not here to kill innocent Afghans, but to fight the spread of violent ideologies. In my time in Afghanistan, the Afghan rule, the people in the rural community did not understand why foreign forces were in Afghanistan. It was not properly communicated to them, and why they focused so much more on Western ideologies being forced on the Afghan public, especially when it came to women empowerment. And there was a larger influence in Kabul. We should make a caveat here that Kabul does not represent the whole country. In fact, it's quite disconnected. Those that are in Kabul are well aware of the current events and understand the foreign footprints and why the war is ongoing, and through their engagement with diplomatic missions and private investors or journalists. But that cannot be the same account for people in Helmand and Nuristan.
Uh-huh.
I've witnessed early in my career that the disconnect and the lack of communication amongst the people and the Afghan government is where the issues rise, and this is the sensitivity of Afghan women. The Western ideology of empowerment cannot be accepted in Afghanistan if it has not been accepted in the region. Currently, if you look at the region, we have issues of female in the gender gap within Pakistan, India, Iran. So how can we go into Afghanistan, that is a much smaller nation and less established, but all of a sudden want to provide all these rights and not even explain to the women's what their rights are?
Mm.
So
can I just jump in here for a second, because this is very interesting, Maryam, and I appreciate you opening our eyes to this, because as you well know, any number of senior level U.S. diplomats and members of the military, I mean, that clip from General Allen being just one of them, when asked, again, from the American perspective, granted, what's the one thing that made these past 18 years justified? Frequently, they will point to women in Afghanistan. It's what they tell the American people, that 18 years of conflict and war in Afghanistan was worth it because of what the U.S. helped usher in for Afghan women. Are you saying that that's not true?
No, the 18 years was worth it because we have education opportunities in Afghanistan. The 18 years are worth it because we have access to healthcare in Afghanistan. The 18 years are worth it because Afghans were able to move away from a certain segment of war. The Mujahideen did not only fight the Red Army, but they also fought Afghans, especially in the rural areas.
Right.
So when the foreign forces came, that diverted that engagement. Yes, we are still in a current state of war. The Afghan Taliban just announced that they're only fighting the Afghan National Defense Security Forces. That's a current state of war. However, the 18 years are the opportunities that were provided were for all Afghans. It was not only for the Afghan women. And if we want to look at the progress of Afghan women, I want to let you know that many of the women that are in power are there symbolically. They very rarely have executive power. And this is a concern, and this is something that I've fought over and over with multiple officials within the Afghan government that you can't just have a female in the room and not give her a voice. Mm. She needs to be incorporated in the policymaking decision and execute certain decisions. However, it's very superficial.
And can I just jump in here? I'm so sorry, are the gains that you just laid out, that were gains for all Afghan people, are they at risk of slipping back if we eventually do see a progressive drawdown of U.S. troops in Afghanistan?
I mean, I can only go by what the Afghan Taliban are stating and what other parties are stating. The Afghan Taliban have been very clear that education will not be eliminated. They're not going to continue to burn schools or break down these opportunities. They're saying that the access to healthcare will be available. Mm-hmm. So based on these terms that they have clearly identified, I don't think that we will fall back. I know that everybody has a mixture of hope and fear here, especially the Afghans. But fear is because of the unknown. They don't know what's going to happen. And this is where the world community is responsible, because you have to continue to monitor and you have to engage and intervene when you find that many of the gains of the past 18 years are not accessible anymore, right? So when it comes to Afghan women, we have to look at this population as Afghans together. Highlighting Afghan women as the gains for the past 18 years, you're causing friction within the Afghan men and women in Afghanistan.
Mm.
And it's enough that the Afghan men are fighting one another. We cannot have this engagement within the women and the men. Mm. You have to, the whole community needs to evolve, because when you are leaving a man that's behind, and there's going to be tension within the household, and you have to understand that the Afghan culture, it's a very traditional culture. The Afghan men, it's a patriarchal society. As much as we've had many narratives that it is starting to rise as a matriarchal society because we've lost many men and women are now leading the households, but many of the men have a larger say. If a woman is going to leave, if she's going to have educational opportunities, or if she's going to work, it's with the permission of her husband, her father, or her brother within that household. So we have to evolve as a community.
Yeah. Well, let me just let folks know that just to remind them that we are talking about the agreement signed between the United States and the Taliban this weekend. And we want to hear from listeners. If you're Afghan, do you think this signifies a major turning point? The agreement is being called historic. If you served in Afghanistan, what do you think about the fact that the U.S. and the Taliban reached this point? Does it mean anything significant to you based on your experience when deployed in Afghanistan? Michael, I appreciate your patience a lot here, but just reflect on what you've heard Mariam say so far about Afghan women and sort of the fundamental changes that have happened in the country.
Well, I mean, I think it's true that there have been some very notable changes in Afghanistan, including ones for the better. And, you know, it seems that over the last 2 years, for good reason, Afghanistan has been one big bad news story, particularly in media coverage here in the U.S., as it should be. But indeed, there have been a number of advances. And I would argue that women's rights, women's education has been a major advance, and that certainly those advances could be squandered if the peace process doesn't start or if it falls apart. But, you know, I think that the major point here to highlight is that what happened on Saturday, the deal between the U.S. and the Taliban, it really is a milestone because it really is the first formal type of agreement or deal that the Taliban has signed with anyone, particularly the United States. And, you know, at the end of the day, it puts Afghanistan on a potential path to launching a peace process. And I emphasize potential for all the reasons that we heard from Ambassador Dobbins earlier. There's a lot of obstacles. And I think what really stands out about this agreement is that, yes, it's a milestone, but also it's a huge gamble.
Right.
Because it appears to give the Taliban a lot without requiring much in return. I mean, the agreement says that in just a few months, several thousand U.S. troops will leave with no conditions. There's supposed to be a release of 5,000 Taliban prisoners in a few days. There are going to be efforts to try to get the Taliban off UN sanctions lists by the end of May. And in return, what do we have the Taliban agree to do? Sever ties with international terrorists in ways that are laid out in the agreement, but in somewhat of a vague way and without any clear vindication of how the Taliban, how efforts by the Taliban to sever those ties with international terrorists will actually be monitored and enforced.
So it sounds like the bare minimum in exchange then.
Right. And there's also been some mixed messaging. I mean, we've heard senior U.S. administration officials over the last few days say things at odds with what's in the agreement. The agreement does not the agreement suggests that the Taliban needs to be talking to the Afghan government, and then U.S. forces will start leaving with the idea of having all U.S. forces leave within the next 14 months. But then you had the defense secretary, the U.S. defense secretary, say yesterday that no, the Taliban really needs to be focused heavily on talking and making progress, talking about a ceasefire. So there's just a lot of mixed messaging and a lot of confusion, which makes a complicated process all the more difficult to make sense of.
Right. Well, Mariam, help us understand something, because it sounds like everything regarding the future for the Afghan people themselves completely hinges upon the Taliban and the Afghan government's willingness to talk, right? Those intra-Afghanistan talks. Do you have optimism about that happening in a meaningful way?
The Afghan government is supposed to represent the Afghan public. But unfortunately, we've witnessed that this was the lowest turnout and President Ghani won with a razor-thin blade. With the razor-thin blade ratio here. And during my years within the Afghan government, I've noticed there is a gap between the government and the people. So I think that the Taliban shouldn't have completely excluded the Afghan government and should allow a seat. But I understand the will for the Afghan Taliban to just speak to the public directly. Now, we have to, there's a few things that you need to witness. I understand why the Afghan government is also upset. Mm. The Afghan government here are fighting multiple forces. They're fighting international terrorists, regional terrorists, the Afghan Taliban, and criminal activity. So they're stretched very thin. But I've also noticed that they're also not trying to engage with the Afghan Taliban. President Ghani has yet to make a national address in the national language, sending a message to the Afghan Taliban to come communicate directly to me. He speaks at them rather than to them, and he speaks through certain messages from the United States or through other allies. There is an issue here that the world community has failed Afghanistan after the defeat of the USSR. So there is a trust deficit between the Afghans and the world community, and that's the fear of abandonment. And that fear of abandonment is what's going to cause the friction within the Afghan people speaking to the Afghan Taliban, because they don't want the international community completely leave. So the reduction in violence, which has ended today, and many can assume that it ended because President Ghani decided that he's not going to release the prisoners, and then the Afghan Taliban announced that they were going to fight the Afghan National Defense Security Forces, which is not the case. To me, it seems that peace is not a possibility, but ending violence is. Mm-hmm. And that can be best enforced by continuing to advocate for this. Another thing that I want to bring clarity to...
Wait, Mariam, I must ask you, because you said something very interesting there. Peace is not a possibility, but ending violence is.
Yes.
What does that mean? What is an Afghan an Afghanistan that has no violence but isn't at peace? What does that look like?
Well, there's a lot of tension here. This is 40 years of war. It's not only 18 that you're reflecting to.
Right.
We had a civil war. We had a Soviet invasion, etc.
Yeah.
So a violence ending could be a path towards peace. Peace is us living harmoniously amongst one another and the possibility of no other foreign terrorists in Afghanistan. We have ISIS. We have other regional terrorist groups in Afghanistan. So I don't think that Afghanistan is in any place, not for the next 10 to 15 years, to be even discussing a framework for peace. Mm. It's ending violence that we need to focus on.
Michael, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think we have to be very realistic about what we can get here. I agree with Mariam that it's going to be a very long, hard slog to get to any type of peace. I think we need to lower our expectations a bit, particularly in the near term. And I think that if we want to try to get a sense of how far can this peace process go, there are two fundamental questions that I think we have to address. One is the Afghan government capable of making this happen, so to speak. This is a government that is very fractured. There are deep, deep rivalries within the Afghan political class. This is a moment when you need the Afghan government to come together in a common front to set a path toward peace and negotiate with the Taliban. Is this Afghan government and the broader Afghan political class in a position to do that? I don't know. Secondly, does the Taliban really want peace? Right. It's been saying all the right things for so long, but, you know, at the end of the day, does the Taliban really want to share power with people that it rejects and within a political system that it has long vowed to overthrow by force? You know, it's a simple question. Does the Taliban really want peace? But I think the question is, can we create the incentive structure in a negotiation where the Taliban would agree that it's best to stop fighting and start talking? Right. We'll see.
Well, Michael Kugelman and Mariam Wardak, stand by here. When we come back, we'll hear from our listeners as well. But we are talking about the agreement signed between the United States and the Taliban this weekend and what comes next, not just for the United States, but more specifically for the Afghan people. We've got a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about how to understand the agreement reached between the United States and the Taliban, the agreement that was signed between the U.S. and the Taliban this weekend. It marks a historic point in America's most recent 18-year involvement in the region. And I'm joined today by Michael Kugelman. He's Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. He's with us from Washington. And in New York, Mariam Wardak joins us. She's served under two presidential administrations in the Afghan government, most recently in the Office of the National Security Council in President Ghani's administration. Mariam is also founder of Her Afghanistan, an online platform supporting Afghan women in the fields of security, peace, foreign policy, and technology. Let's get a couple of calls in here. Let's go to Sam, who's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Sam, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me. So I spent three tours in Afghanistan, first as an army interrogator, then as an intelligence officer. And I mean, I think overwhelmingly there's public support to end this conflict. And so I'm really enthusiastic about this this step forward that the president's taking. You know, something, this is something that, you know, both the former president and the current president ran on, was ending this conflict. But I've also seen these agreements fall apart. And, you know, the longer we spent there, the more fractured the Taliban have become, the more infighting there is. So I'm optimistic, but I think that this could be distracting from the fact that really what we need is to get the Congress engaged in ending the 2001 AUMF. You know, the American troops on the ground have punished the Taliban, destroyed al-Qaeda, and killed bin Laden, which is really what we were sent there to do. And I just think there needs to be more congressional engagement to move that forward or to redefine what it is U.S. military is doing in Afghanistan.
Right. Well, Sam, thank you so much for your perspective and for that call. Let's go straight to Christopher, who's calling from Clearwater, Florida. And Christopher, you just heard Sam there feeling cautiously optimistic, given his experience and his service in Afghanistan. Do you feel the same way?
I appreciate his perspective, but I'm not sure that I feel as optimistic. As a combat veteran of Operation Enduring Freedom, I, in speaking with some of my veteran colleagues, especially after the Afghan papers came out, just how furious we are on the sacrifices that my brothers and sisters in arms made over there, and that now we're negotiating with a terrorist group. I mean, the group that housed al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. Responsible for the death of over 3,000 Americans on our own soil. And so it's disheartening to me. Of course, I don't want any more troops in harm's way, but this was so fumbled. And one of your guests commented on Pakistan. I don't think enough attention was given to Pakistan, and the border wasn't secured. And there should have been swift and direct sanctions.
Yeah.
It's great that we killed Osama bin Laden, but we killed him in Pakistan. I mean, it should have been an absolute outrage that type of movement through the border, where the head of al-Qaeda can live in a giant base.
Yeah.
And so at this point, I only pray for peace for the Afghan people. They're some of the kindest people I've met in my life. And it's just disheartening to see this all happen.
Christopher, thank you so much for your call. So Miriam and Michael, lots of things just in the context of those two calls. First of all, we should note that when Christopher mentioned the Afghanistan papers, that was the incredible investigative series from The Washington Post. That looked through a cache of thousands of documents and interviews that the United States government itself did about mistakes that were made and what was known and not shared with the American people about progress or lack thereof in Afghanistan over the past 18 years. We spoke with the reporter who behind that investigation. So folks, go to onpointradio.org and look up the Afghanistan papers, and you'll hear all about that. But Miriam, let me just start with you here about what Christopher said about Pakistan, because you were talking about not looking at Afghanistan in isolation, that we also have to consider it in the region there. So respond to what Christopher said about Pakistan.
Well, I think Christopher reflected Pakistan in the sense of influence of in the political sphere and also mm-hmm. Funding insurgency.
Yeah.
So I think that Pakistan has a negative influence in Afghanistan. I think I've noticed a change in their policy. I've noticed one that they're much more vocal versus before, where they would stay quiet and then we would there'd be mass revelations of destruction that they've caused to the Afghan government. However, I think that now the change in policy, and I think that the Afghan government should now directly engage publicly with Pakistan on taking a more stronger stance against their influence. And we see that with the deal currently, how much influence Pakistan had over the Afghan Taliban coming to this agreement.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think Christopher also gets to something that perhaps is even more resonant with listeners right now. And that is when they think of the Taliban, they think of the people who gave shelter and support to al-Qaeda. Is that who the Taliban are today? Who is the Taliban, Miriam?
I want to reflect that the Afghan Taliban are not the Taliban of the 1990s. It's a generation transition. So today, the Afghan Taliban are those that are were influenced by Iran, influenced by other regional countries, and by Pakistan. There are very few of them, unless you look at the foot soldiers that were raised in Afghanistan and currently fighting, but those that are making decisions and directing the foot soldiers are those that are influenced by foreign countries. So they look at what's in their best interest. And at the end of the day, the Afghan Taliban are also those that want to be in power. So this is nothing but a big political game and causing harm to the Afghan innocent lives, as well as others who fought against this war. So there is a generation transition, but we've noticed in the ceasefire of last Eid, the three-day ceasefire, when the Afghan Taliban foot soldiers re-entered into the city. There were about 30, 40,000 of them. And I was in Kabul at that time, and I engaged with a few. They were eating cotton candy, listening to music, taking selfies with Afghan female journalists. I was grocery shopping because Eid is a major holiday for us. Mm-hmm. And as I left the grocery shop, my guard was also helping me with bags. And one of the Taliban who were walking towards me, and I was like, okay, what's going to happen? This is my first engagement. He opened my door. So they're different, and they want to reintegrate within society. They want to be back in their own homes. And some of these have been pulled away from their homes for the past 10 to 15 years, or however many years they've been recruited. So there's a change there, and that is why the Afghan Taliban leaders called this a reduction in violence and not another ceasefire, because they saw the will of the Afghan foot soldiers wanting to end the war.
So then, you know, earlier when Michael asked the question of does the Taliban really want peace, what would be your impression, your answer to that?
Well, again, it's a who you're speaking to. If you're talking to the foot soldiers, they want peace. But if you're talking to those who are power hungry or who want to, because this is all about sharing power, right? This is why they don't want to discuss with the Afghan government, and they want to directly negotiate with the U.S. government, because they think that the U.S. government has a say on forming whatever administration there is. That's the elephant in the room.
I mean, it's a massive elephant though, isn't it, Michael?
Oh, absolutely. No, for sure. But, you know, the thing with the Taliban is we hear the Taliban referred to as a group of terrorists. And, you know, for good reason. These folks, they do horrible things. They blow up ambulances. They do terrible things. But, you know, according to the U.S. government, the Afghan Taliban is not a terrorist group. The U.S. government has never formally designated the Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, as a terrorist organization. And I think that's in part because of the view that maybe one day down the road there would be an opportunity to conduct a negotiation with the Taliban, which of course is what happened. And you know, another thing about the Taliban, I agree with Mariam that you could have new generations. Things have changed a lot. A lot of time has gone by since the late 90s. And also, you know, the Taliban does like to project itself as a true insurgent organization trying to win hearts and minds. You know, the Taliban controls a lot of territory in Afghanistan right now, more than at any time since U.S. forces entered in 2001. And so the Taliban is always looking for ways to convince Afghans or persuade Afghans that it is a more just, less corrupt version of the Afghan government. And that has helped the Taliban recruit. And, you know, you do have a sizable area, quite a few districts in Afghanistan controlled by the Taliban. And the Taliban tries to act, you know, not in the sense of a terrorist type of government, but as it tries to project itself as a genuine shadow government, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And this gets to another issue. Going back to Pakistan, one of your callers mentioned Pakistan. Mm-hmm. I agree that Pakistan is a big problem in this whole story. And it's true. Many academic studies have showed that when insurgent groups enjoy cross-border sanctuaries, as the Taliban does in Pakistan, they rarely lose. But you know what? There are other things as well that have kept this insurgency strong over the years. And one of them is the fact that the successive Afghan governments have been unable to convince a critical mass of Afghan people that the Afghan government is a better alternative to the Taliban.
Right.
And this has enabled the Taliban to keep recruiting for so many years. So it's a very complicated thing.
Excellent point. Yeah, go ahead, Mary. We just got a minute left to go, but go ahead.
Sure. If I may, I wanted to inform your listeners that the Afghan Taliban weren't always known as the bad guys. I'm not over here advocating for the Afghan Taliban, but I want to give everybody a holistic picture here. That the Afghan Taliban emerged during the civil war when the Mujahideen were not only fighting that Red Army, but also Afghans in the rural areas. The Afghan Taliban emerged as peace leaders. And the former president Rabbani and other major leaders of Afghanistan called them the peacemakers. And they came and ended the violence, ended the civil war. And I would like to highlight that opium cultivation was at complete zero. And at that time, it was the safest time in Afghanistan. Men would leave their shops open or leave their homes with their door opens and go to prayer. So it was a different time. Yes, then 9/11 happened. And instead of engaging with the Taliban directly, of course, I understand that all these lives that were lost in America, they went and attacked Afghans in Afghanistan. And the reason why the Afghan Taliban housed, although it was wrong and they should have handed Osama bin Laden over, Osama bin Laden was one of the fighters who fought with the Afghans side by side against the Soviet invasion. And I think that we keep forgetting to mention this to the public, that this is why when the Afghans have a hospitality code, that anybody who comes into their homes as a guest, they will never ask them to leave.
Right.
So when Osama bin Laden came into Afghanistan, unfortunately plotting whatever he did, he asked them to house them. And then the Afghan Taliban, based on their own code, let him stay. But there was engagements. The Afghan Taliban did try to engage with Americans, but at that time, emotions were hot, really warm, and we had the Patriot Act, and it was just an eye for an eye, unfortunately.
And we should note they were fighting against the Soviet invasion with the support of the United States at that time. So, I mean, that's an excellent reminder that even though that an agreement was signed this weekend, we're simply at the beginning of the next chapter in terms of Afghanistan's story. So with that, Maryam Wardak, she served under two presidential administrations in the Afghan government and is founder of Her Afghanistan as well. Maryam, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. My thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I wanted to spend the last couple of minutes of this hour today with Jack Beattie, On Point's news analyst, with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, because it was in the immediate aftermath of the attacks of September 11th, and just the days after, that this program first went on the air in the evenings, and Jack was there from the start. So, Jack, it's good to talk with you on this historic moment here, 18 years later. What are you thinking? How are you feeling? Where's your mind?
My mind is with Donald Trump. We don't usually credit him with moral lucidity, and yet, in a January 2018 tweet, he exemplified it. He said the U.S. has foolishly given Pakistan more than $33 billion in aid over the last 15 years, and they have given us nothing but lies and deceit. They give safe haven to the terrorists we fight in Afghanistan no more. Contrast the Obama administration. Someone said the Obama administration thought, you just hang in there and Pakistan will see the light. So Trump announced a cutoff of U.S. aid. And that was a triumph in this sordid story, because successive U.S. presidents have sent 700,000 American troops to Afghanistan on the one hand, while providing munificent aid to Pakistan on the other, which has aided and succored the very people who are killing American troops. I just can't get away from that morally unconscionable duplicity to the American people. Yes, we knew that we were aiding Pakistan, but I don't remember a question to President Obama. How can you do this? How can you give aid to this country that is helping to kill our soldiers? And so I'm at this moment, I'm thinking, let's hope at least that absurdity can end.
You know, we've got 30 seconds left, Jack, and it just reminded me of something Maryam said earlier in the hour when she said peace may not be a possibility in Afghanistan, but at least perhaps a reduction of violence is. And that to her was profoundly meaningful in and of itself. Just in the 30 seconds we have, Jack, what do you think about that?
Yes, life matters. And all this sacrifice of blood and treasure, if it can be made worthwhile by more people living, fine. But Ambassador Dobbins has said, you can tell whether we're succeeding or failing. Are more civilians living or dying? Last year, the height of civilian deaths in Afghanistan.
Mm. Well, Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst. Jack, it's always great to talk with you, especially over these many years and many years to come. So thanks so much for being with us today, Jack.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.